Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. Jim, we start with the good. It comes from Noah Rothman over at Hot Air, who has a very interesting story that's entitled, "The Left Made Scott Walker a Candidate. The Press is Turning Him into a Force." And essentially, the point is that with all these ridiculous little gotcha moments that the press has had with Scott Walker, or they think they've had with Scott Walker, about evolution or whether the president is a Christian, the people actually paying attention to this race know these are essentially gotcha questions. And with all the different concerns going on in the country and on the international stage right now, they don't see these as all that relevant when it comes to determining who they want to be the next president of the United States. So all the press is really doing is giving a lot of free attention to Scott Walker, and it's showing up in the polls in the early primary states. He's got a fairly healthy lead in Iowa. He's also looking pretty good in New Hampshire and South Carolina. Obviously, as we learned in 2012, there can be a lot of ups and downs before we get to actual voting. But in terms of how Scott Walker would hope to surge to the front of the pack, he couldn't have asked for something better than this.
Imagine if the left had never made a recall effort against Scott Walker in 2012. He still would be hated by the left. He pushed through his reforms to public sector unions. The left responded with a volcanic rage, right? And the protests trying to shut down the state capitol and the endless lawsuits and going to the state Supreme Court. People like you and I would have heard of Scott Walker, but basically he'd be like, John Kasich or Mike Pence, right? A fairly conservative, respected Midwestern Republican governor who, he might make an interesting presidential candidate, right? But instead, over at Ace of Spades, they keep portraying him as sort of like Conan the Barbarian. this guy who has taken, who became public enemy number one to Democratic parties, to unions, to the media and MSNBC. We all remember Ed Schultz disputing the decision desk on the night of the recall election. And, once he withstood the recall, he really became, I don't say a heroic figure, might be overstating it, but a much more prominent and a much more, I think, important and consequential figure in Republican politics. And then they had another bite at the apple last year because there was a certain number of folks who were opposed to the recall but not going to oppose voting against him in a regular election. And he won re-election pretty handily there. And so here you have a circumstance of almost running quasi-national campaigns in the state of Wisconsin, which is not the most fertile territory for Republicans. And twice, with absolutely everything thrown at him, he came out victorious. And so you look at that and you're like, wait a second. The reason you and I think really highly of Scott Walker is because he's faced down the left twice. There was a site that described, they put it this way. They threw the kitchen sink at the guy in 2012, and then they threw their neighbor's sink at him in 2014, and now no one in the block will allow them inside to go to the bathroom. So now, he makes these utterances in these interviews with Bob Costa and Dan Balls, The Washington Post or something, and they try to say, oh my goodness, he didn't say Barack Obama was a Christian. This is, The New Yorker declared him dangerous, Greg. The dangerous Scott Walker, And it just... Ann Althaus is observing, wait a second, this is really the exact same dynamic that we saw in 2012 and that we saw in 2014 against Scott Walker, and it didn't work either time. And if it didn't work either time in Wisconsin, is it likely to work nationally this time around? And I think there's a really interesting question. It's very counterintuitive, but the frothing at the mouth, unhinged, hostile press that the Scott Walker campaign is getting may be his strongest ally in a GOP primary race.
Yes, the fact that the national press detests him should give you your first indication that he's somebody you want to take a closer look at. And I think the point that you made there that perhaps suits him best for the national campaign to come is that he's been through this before. One of the things that really was a problem when folks were checking out people other than Mitt in 2012 was that they hadn't been through the media microscope before, and so a lot of them stumbled along the way. Scott Walker has been doing this really for 4 years now, and obviously it's going to get even more intense as he eventually gets in this race, most likely. But this isn't his first rodeo, and so I think he's going to be far more disciplined and more savvy than a lot of folks who haven't been on this stage and in this position before.
Yeah, and let's observe, like, what drives our listeners crazy, my readers crazy, and the average the average grassroots conservative is crazy, is the unfair, dirty pool, partisan nastiness of the major national media and their insistence that they're really objective and fair and not, you know, hacks. The fact that, you know, Scott Walker seems like the guy who can overcome that, who can overcome MSNBC becoming basically, you know, not just running attack ads, but the programming is attack ads. And come out with standing, that's really exactly what conservatives have wanted to see for a really long time. So the guy who can really push back against that is the guy who is probably most likely in a very strong position to win the nomination.
You know, just to thumb his nose at the national press and the unions a little bit more, it's pretty likely in the next few days or a couple of weeks here, he's going to be signing right-to-work legislation in Wisconsin, which is, you know, essentially good news for MSNBC. They won't have to fire Ed Schultz because he'll spontaneously combust.
It's job security for him.
All right. And another thing people like about Scott Walker, of course, is that he rolled up his sleeves and got to work on some tough issues and got results, which brings us to our bad martini. The Republicans, of course, control both the House and Senate. One of the promises, of course, during the 2014 campaign was that if you can give us the Senate, we'll be able to stop Barack Obama. Shortly after the midterm election and the Republicans got those majorities, Obama came out with what many are calling his unconstitutional amnesty. Others call it deferred deportation. Republicans at that point promised to do whatever they could to stop this from taking place. What we got was the Cromnibus strategy, funding everything except the Department of Homeland Security through the end of the fiscal year, but saving the Department of Homeland Security and this funding for the immigration slash amnesty program for the end of February. Well, here we are. The House passed the funding without the funding for the president's immigration program. The Senate couldn't get the 60 votes to move it forward. So now there's going to be two different votes, one on a clean funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security, the other separate to defund the president's money for amnesty, which will never get the 60 votes either. Also on Tuesday, the president, as promised, vetoed the Keystone XL pipeline. And if those weren't bad enough on Tuesday, the Senate also essentially admitted they don't have the votes to stop whatever the heck is in this FCC net neutrality plan. So, Jim, talk about your no good, very bad day.
Let's start in reverse order of consequence. The Obama veto is kind of, you know, kind of what we expected. As noted over in Hot Air, the fact that the claim was that it's infringing upon the president's power. The cojones on this guy. How dare you pass legislation in a bipartisan manner, no less. So, I mean, we kind of said, look, creating a Republican Senate was going to force Obama to make some uncomfortable vetoes. I guess the interesting thing is, like, we all kind of assumed it's actually kind of a comfortable veto for him because he just doesn't care anymore. And so that's not an intriguing indicator of how difficult this is going to be. And I think what you're seeing on all these fronts is, like, the midterm election did not mitigate Obama's agenda or ambitions or power grab or willingness to be brazen and ignore the Constitution. The midterms accelerated it, and that's kind of a slap to the face of conservatives. You and I last week talked about the filibuster. Charles Krauthammer announcing he's been radicalized, he wants the nuclear option, he's kind of said enough of this stuff. Put another way, I think it was Dana Milbank said, Democrats, you know, experiment with obstructionism and decide that they like it. I kind of am starting to come around to this, and we can continue that debate some other day, because the idea of this FCC thing, look, you're not, you know, now the Democrats are in the minority and they have the filibuster. Obama has even more leverage to, you know, create the government the way he does. And then on the immigration thing, there are people who have been, you know, tweeting at me today saying, well, you said get a Republican Senate. What difference did it make? What great difference? You know, maybe this is where you got to put your line in the sand. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but when the president's going to ignore the Constitution and be making these power grabs on every possible front simultaneously, maybe we got to have another. We had one in the early on in the cycle of the 2014 cycle, and it didn't hurt Republicans at all. Now, we were helped out by the fact that, you know, Obamacare blew up and a lot of other things went really bad for the president. But I think there's a need to draw a line in the sand. And I think the executive order amnesty is a perfectly good place to do it. And we can say, look, no, we are not going to give you the money to implement an executive amnesty. You don't have the power to do this. And let's have that fight. Let's draw that line in the sand and let's see. Because even if you have to, you know, even if you lose, your base at least knows you tried. And I kind of feel like the idea of you know, passing, never mind. It is really going to depress the hell out of the Republican base, make them wonder if this is really a point to all this, if we're always going to be sold out by our leadership. Sometimes there is value in fighting and losing and demonstrating that you have the fight than conceding without the fight.
Even days ago, I mean, McConnell made this announcement, I guess, late Monday, early Tuesday. Lindsey Graham, the weekend before, was saying, oh, the best thing for us is just to hope that the court system works out and that this judge is really in Texas gets upheld by the Supreme Court. Yeah. And so the Senate can just abdicate the entire fight. I just think you got conservative heads banging against the wall, though I don't think too many are surprised to see that particular argument coming from him.
Earlier in the week, Orrin Hatch was speaking over at the Heritage Foundation. Orrin Hatch, you know, there are some people who say he's a squish, but you look at his ACU rating, he's not Charlie Crist. He's not Arlen Specter. You know, he's a Utah senator. And he said, look, there were the people, look, let's say the Supreme Court comes down in King versus Burwell and says, yeah, if you bought through the federal exchange, you don't get a subsidy. Well, all of a sudden, people who are counting on getting a big tax credit don't get it. And they're going to be like, oh my God, I can't afford my health insurance anymore. Orrin Hatch wants to do something about that. Orrin Hatch, you know, realizes, like, wait a minute, you know, there are going to be a lot of people who are really upset about this, and the president will be very happy to blame us. It sounds like he's okay with, at least for a year, restoring the tax credit. Can you imagine if the Supreme Court, like many other people skeptical, will actually rule against giving the credit to people who get through the federal exchanges? They won't rule the way most Republicans want them to do. They won't effectively destroy Obamacare. But if they did, Greg, could you imagine if one of the first things the Republicans in Congress did is save Obamacare from the decisions of the Supreme Court?
Oh, gosh.
People like me who have said, look, vote for the Republican, take every little step you can to move the things slightly in a rightward direction. The guy who's with you 80% of the time who can win is better than the guy who's 100% who can't win. But that really makes that argument look wrong if Republicans' first step is to go out and save Obamacare from a Supreme Court decision, which was exactly what we wanted because we said, look, this is what the law says. For everybody up frustrated in the grassroots, I hear you, and I'm feeling it too, and I'm hoping people on Capitol Hill are hearing these messages.
This is not...
That's a bad martini.
That's not a bad
martini.
It's not the martini we were hoping for 2 months into this majority. All right, on to the crazy martini now, and this is a really good crazy martini, actually. If you know a little bit of the background of the region, not too shocking, but still, it's very good news. From the Jerusalem Post, not only are the Israelis worried about a emerging Iranian nuclear weapons program, but so are the Saudis. It's the whole Shia versus Sunni problem. And of course, the Saudis hate the Iranians probably just as much as any other Arab country in the region. And so, according to the Jerusalem Post, they're working on a tentative deal with the Israelis that the Israeli Defense Forces can use Saudi airspace to attack Iranian nuclear facilities if and when that time comes, so long as there's some progress, which was very undefined, actually, in the article, on the larger Middle East-Palestinian peace process question. So, Jim, not exactly the allies you expect, but, you know, strange times call for strange bedfellows here.
Not what we would have expected, and you kind of wonder how long-lasting this alliance would be. But, look, you know, the Iranian nuclear program is a game-changer. It had for a long time, the policy of presidents up until fairly recently was Iran will not get a nuclear bomb. There cannot be an Iranian nuclear bomb. It is just too destabilizing. They are too dangerous. It creates an arms race in the Middle East. It increases the possibility somebody's going to do it. This is a regime that consistently uses apocalyptic rhetoric and that's, honest to goodness, sponsors terrorism, i.e. in places like Argentina, uses terrorist proxies all around the world, has had an effective working relationship with Al-Qaeda, according to, you know, going back in terms of travel and transit and things like that. They are, you know, too dangerous to be trusted with a nuclear weapon. And now the policy of this administration is they will be allowed to have a nuclear weapon parts that would take a while to assemble and the radioactive materials and things like that that are required to it. This is actually a really big change in American policy. We're basically saying you can't have an assembled gun, but you can have the gun that would take you a while to assemble, which is a very big concession on our part. And it's not really clear what we get for that concession. And so I think that to a lot of other regimes, including Israel and Saudi Arabia, no, that's not acceptable. And if the only way this program gets stopped is by dropping heavy bombs on it, you know, the other part of countries in the world might feel a need to do this. I'm sure this is another part of the administration's strategic patience and leading from behind.
Jim, you know, one of the big motivators for Osama bin Laden allegedly was that Saudis let U.S. troops on Saudi soil during the Gulf War.
That's a good point. Hey, wait, whoa, whoa, yeah.
I'd love to bring him.
Terrible.
I'd love
the Israelis, right? Who you've been demonizing.
I'd love to bring him back to life for about 10 minutes to get his reaction to the Saudis letting the Israelis use their airspace to attack the Iranians. That'd be awesome.
When the Navy SEALs kicked down your door, I'm sure you felt like you lost. Well, let us show you just how much you lost.
Good news, finally, from the Middle East. It's tentative. But
well, the Middle East gives us our good news. That's just how bad things have gotten in Washington.
Exactly. Jim, you're at CPAC the next couple of days, so we'll talk to you again on Monday. Good luck surviving.
You know, it's as I'm about to announce on National Review, it's totally not a circus, despite the fact there are people on stilts and people in Star Wars costumes. It's not a circus. Totally not at all. And Trump. And Paul Robertson. But it's not a circus. Oh, and they're having a reality show competition for journalism students. But it's totally not a circus, Greg. See you Monday.
Oh, can't wait. Can't wait for the report on that. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please join us again on Thursday, though, for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.